Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. The Americans have many self-gratifying metaphors of why they and only they are supposed to be at the top of the international pecking order. The world's leading democracy, shining city on a hill, a benevolent hegemon, all to support the idea that in the final analysis, they have an inborn prerogative to know and decide what's best for the rest. And as order and peace preserving as this positioning wishes to appear, isn't it bound to lead to conflict? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined from Canada by Victor Takei, who teaches at Concordia University of Edmonton. Victor, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for the invitation, Oksana. It's a pleasure to be in this program.
Victor, you have a very interesting take on the current tensions between Russia and the West, which ultimately comes down to the side's deep-seated perception of themselves and the nature of reality, which you summarize as the U.S.'s insistence on being the first among equals and Russia's claim on being an equal among firsts. Do you think such a clash of self-images could be resolved peacefully?
Well, I hope it can be, but of course it is problematic given the how deep this cultural difference is, given how deep the psychological difference is ultimately in terms of the collective psychology of the leadership of the two sides, right? Indeed, this is the idea that came to me probably as a result of my teaching for a number of years at two religious institutions, ultimately, right? Two smaller universities here in Edmonton, both of which are Protestant foundations at the beginning. And this is something that made me look into this religious origins of political culture of the West and of the United States of America in particular. And then, of course, my own research as a historian had to do with the cultural history of diplomacy on the Russian side, right? And specifically the cultural history of the Russian Ottoman Wars. So there I paid a lot of attention to the, once again, the cultural practices of diplomacy, the perceptions, the representations.
And we will definitely discuss all of those differences. And I think your main point is that both Russia and America are exceptionally distinct in how they evolved historically and economically and socially. And before we go into that, I wonder if you can see any similarity in how these two big nations, two great powers, go about manifesting themselves in the world.
Well, you see, historians are above all those who look for differences, for peculiarities, for unique qualities of historical entities, right, that are there, that confront each other. It is probably the task of the political scientists and the sociologists to focus on the similarities, on the universal reproducible trends, right? But once again, I would above all emphasize this difference. Mm-hmm. And yet, in as much as there were periods when the two sides treated each other on more or less equal terms, my argument would be that these were rather exceptional in the longer history of their relations.
Let me seize on that word exceptional, because it's first and foremost associated with the American exceptionalism. And you argued that the United States is exceptional in two major ways. It's geography, or rather geography granted security, being buffered by two oceans and two weaker neighbors, and its exceptional ability to strike with impunity without fearing any retribution, which essentially allowed the Americans to wage their wars over the last couple of decades and perhaps even longer. Now, do you think Russia is exceptional enough as an adversary to, and my pun is intended, to provide an exception to the typical ways of American exceptionalism?
Well, I would say that it's exceptional in its desire, historically, in its desire to be equal among the firsts, which was the product of its long efforts to join the European concert, the European balance of power, the European club of great powers, and also the fact that it was part of that club for about a century and a half, or perhaps two centuries. And then its exceptionalism is also a reflection of the fact that it's pretty much the only remaining great power of this kind now in Europe, or and perhaps even in the broader world, right? The tragedy, one may say, of Russia is that this club of European great powers, of which it wanted to be parts for such a long time, is no longer there.
One interesting observation you make, that Russia is perhaps the only, as you said, power that sort of pierced through this perception of being impervious on the part of the Americans. And if we hear, if you listen to the speeches of American policymakers, they say that, you know, they're still the strongest nation in the world, that nothing threatens them. But do you think the Americans indeed feel as secure now as they profess it to be?
Well, certainly not. I mean, one has to understand that until the end of the Second World War, right, there was no feasible prospect of any major attack on the continental territory of the United States, right? And in that sense, the first century and a half of American history passed in exceptionally secure conditions, right? That explains so much in the transformation of the United States of America into a major power, a global power, a power that was actually superior, right, in its capacities to any of the European great powers of the previous period, right? And then, of course, comes the Cold War, which, as I would argue, for a very long time was still an asymmetrical confrontation, given still the great discrepancy in the resources of the two sides, as well as in the level of security that they enjoyed. But still, I would say that the most significant achievement, as it were, of the Soviet Union was to close that gap in terms of, the relative security that the two sides enjoyed. And in that sense, of course, I would say that the Soviet Union compromised, shall we say, the American security to the point of leaving a lasting impression on their, approach to foreign policy, on their collective psychology, on their perception of Russia, even today.
But, you know, Viktor, I've spoken to many historians lately, and many of them point out that during the Cold War, one distinct feature of the Cold War was the fact that both the United States and Russia engaged in a proxy conflict. They never afforded to intervene directly in the neighborhood of each other, with the only exception of the Cuban Missile Crisis, but it was also sparked by, you know, the Turkey's case. And many of them argued that the United States moved to change that approach recently by pushing ever closer to Russian borders and by militarizing Ukraine. If you agree with this thesis, what do you think prompted this change of tactics on the American side? Essentially picking up a battle with Russia directly, or almost directly through Ukraine.
Yes, but first of all, I would actually question the magnitude of that change, right? Because as you mentioned, the Cold War was above all a conflict characterized by a series of proxy wars between the two superpowers that were taking place in Africa, Southeast Asia, other places, right? But which never turned into an actual war. And I think that this is part of the broader trend that we see since the Second World War in terms of this transition into a gray zone of no peace, no war, right? And this clear-cut distinction between peace and war that was once again a characteristic of the European system of international relations in the 18th and 19th century, right? It's disappearing gradually, right? And we are again in this increasingly in this gray zone. What makes the current conflict different, of course, is its geography, right? It's no longer Angola, it's no longer Vietnam, it's no longer Cuba, it is in Ukraine, right? And this is something that makes this conflict different, including in terms of how free or unfree are the two sides to disengage from.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've discussed before this self-assured attitude that the United States historically had about its security, and I think Russia couldn't have been more different. You argue in your article that Russia has never been privileged by an abiding sense of security. Quite on the contrary, it's been chronically insecure. How has it shaped its own national and political psychology?
I think that in the years of the Cold War, that ultimately resulted in that rather sound, I would say, approach of the Soviet military strategists that consisted in challenging the security of the opponent rather than trying to secure its own absolute security, which I think is absolutely unattainable, is an illusion ultimately, you see. And anyone who is remotely
familiar... Is it unattainable only for Russia or the Soviet Union, or you think it's unattainable for the United States as well?
I think that ultimately it's unattainable for any power in today's world. And the reason for that is well known to any specialist on strategy. It's much cheaper, technically easier to deny security to the opponent than to secure absolute, comfort for yourself, as it were, right? To make sure that there is no possible attack on your territory, right? And that's ultimately something that led, in the context of the Cold War, to that famous or infamous doctrine of mutually assured destruction, whereby the security of the two sides was partially achieved through some kind of equilibrium of terror.
And
right?
If I'm not mistaken, that's also an attempt on the part of Russia to take that concept of the balance of power, on which the European concert was premised, broader, and apply it to the Americans as well. Why do you think the Americans played along with it for some time and now seem to be refusing to do so?
Yes. So in that sense, one may say that MAD, or mutually assured destruction, was a kind of recreation or reproduction of the principles and approaches to foreign policy that characterized the European concert. And in that sense, in as much as Russia and the Soviet Union were trying to continue that approach in international relations, they had success. But it's important to remember that this concept and the overall interaction between the United States and the Soviet Union in terms of détente, in terms of the strategic arms limitation talks, the anti-ballistic missile treaty of the early 1970s, that was, I would argue, a rather exceptional period, right, of parity in the context of the Cold War, from which ultimately the United States diverged or parted by the late 1970s, right? So I would once again emphasize the exceptionality of this parity-based approach in the domain of security. And that also only means that Russia or any other power has to make extra effort to bring it about.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking about exceptions, there's absolutely no exception to the rule that we have to take a break in the middle of our conversation. So stay tuned. We will be back in just a few moments.
I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Victor Tucky, who teaches at Concordia University of Edmonton. Now, Victor, you have another fascinating view onto this conflict, which I haven't seen many specialists voice. And essentially, it's an argument that this evolution of the American self-perception as sort of the representation of God on this planet has been, in fact, a combination of not only geography, but also it's a religious thinking, and particularly the influence of the Calvinist ideas of dividing people into, and perhaps nations as well, into the elect ones and the, what was the term?
Reprobate.
The reprobate.
Yes.
Do you see it playing out in the current politics as well?
Well, in a general sense, yes. Well, first of all, let me say that, of course, the United States is not the only country whose political elite thought of themselves along those terms. And indeed, one can find similar themes in the history of Britain, of France, of Russia, right? But when you look, for example, at the Russian version of this nation, especially in special relation to God, right, that we find above all in Russia's 17th century, right, it definitely bears the influence of the Byzantine political culture, in which exceptionality was confirmed, as it were, by exceptionally great challenges, hardships, sufferings that the nation went through, because of course God loves, God makes suffer those whom He loves.
But Victor, I may be wrong here, but I think at least in the Russian conception of this idea, it does not presume that, you know, this exceptionality denies everybody else their exceptionality. There is no sort of aspiration to be, the only arbiter of world affairs.
Yeah, well, that's because in addition to having that kind of Byzantine legacy, once again, that we could see in the 17th century, Russia was at the same time geographically, objectively, a peripheral power, a peripheral nation, which very early on the level of its political elites, recognized its peripheral situation and began to make efforts to overcome it, mm-hmm. right? So as a result of this religious exceptionalism, this religious providentialism became diluted with a very healthy attitude of disciples of mm-hmm. Europe and of the more advanced, technologically advanced nations.
Absolutely. And I think it was also tested by reality, because you make an argument that every major European power also aspired to be a hegemon, but its hegemonic ambitions have always gotten some pushback from the neighbors. That's just, essentially a benefit, so to say, of being in a European environment.
Absolutely. Well, that was the case of Spain that suffered major defeat in the 17th century. That was the case of France that suffered a number of defeats in the 18th and early 19th century, with Napoleon being a major one, right? And that was even the case of Great Britain, right? That was a global power for a long time, but then, of course, at the moment of the conclusion of the Second World War, was very dramatically kind of declassified and turned into a medium-sized country, right? So all European nations ultimately experienced that transformation, where their exceptionalism was kind of defeated by the hard realities, right? Or at least confronted with them in a very significant way. And the United States are more or less the only exception to that general tendency. And that, of course, has to do with the fact that the geographical situation of the United States is fundamentally that of an island that is the size of the continent, right? And that's something that makes them so secure.
I wonder if it also manifests itself domestically, because if we look at all the recent presidential campaigns, you always get some variation of the Hillary Clinton's deplorables comment. You know, I think Donald Trump talked about human scam. Biden also made some disparaging remarks about a sizable part of the population. Do you think this sort of the division of people or nations into the elect and the reprobate also manifests itself in domestically, perhaps in the current polarization in the United States?
In a certain sense, yes. Certainly liberal progressivism can be seen as yet another kind of secular manifestation of that kind of approach, right? Because we have to understand that in its pure pristine form, this religious consciousness of radical Calvinists was present above all in the 17th century, at the time of the creation of the 13 colonies. But since then, it has become secularized for sure. Already by the time of the American War of Independence, we can see significant secularization of that trend that turns into a kind of ideology of success, right? That seems to be kind of confirmed by the actual developments. Again, as a reflection, above all, of the exceptionally comfortable geographical situation, above all.
Now, one can, I think, understand why the Americans would be so infatuated with their own origin myth, but and I think many countries have a similar myth. But again, claiming that your own myth supersedes all others, isn't that ultimately, as well-wishing as it may appear, isn't that ultimately an attempt to deny all other nations to manifest their own destiny? Because I mean, in personal psychology, we accept that each one of us is unique and has his or her own unique way. But essentially, what the American political doctrine tries to put forward is that, no, we know the right way for everybody else, for others.
Yes. Yes, of course. I mean, one of the qualities that distinguishes human beings is the ability to recognize in the other just the same human beings as yourself, right? And in that sense, if we apply these psychological categories to the level of political elites of different countries, again, the exceptional geographical situation of the United States, the exceptionally positive economic and demographic and social development of this country for over the 19th and the 20th century definitely made it difficult, let's say, for the American leaders to recognize in the leaders of other countries their equals, as it were, right? Because once again, the situations, the concerns, the circumstances in which the European leaders, in particular, historically were acting were so manifestly different from those of the United States.
Now, I don't know if you would agree with that, but I think this very concept of the end of history could only be born on the American soil. And as presumptuous as it may be, it reminds me of that Faustian moment, you know, to stop the beautiful moment and essentially to stop the flow of history and prevent others from living their own version of what the Americans have lived through. I mean, that sounds so impossible to even consider, and yet for some reason the Americans seem to be fully devoted to it. Do you think that's an authentic belief, or is it ultimately a deliberate calculation to use the rest of the world as their resource base? Do you think the Americans can stand on their own 2 feet without using the rest of the world as a supporting base?
Well, certainly much of that success story was the product of the very advantageous economic, strategic relations in which the United States were with other countries, right? But at the same time, I think that we have to take culture and political culture in particular seriously, right? Because I do think that here we are dealing with things, with psychological realities that definitely determine or at least condition the choices, the foreign political choices, including in the current crisis.
Now, as you mentioned in your piece, the United States, unlike the United States, Europe has never been insulated from the interstate conflict. And it gave rise to this very specific diplomatic and political culture, which we have already discussed, the European concert, based on the idea of the balance of power, balance of interest, as a way to peacefully coexist and ensure a modicum of what you want. You argue that this way of diplomacy, this way of coexisting, was destroyed during the first two world wars. Do you think there's any chance of recreating it as a way to avoid a third world war, perhaps as a result of it?
Well, I think that it's everybody's hope. It should be everybody's hope that there is such a possibility, right? And indeed, an ideal situation would be something like the reemergence of this European concert of bigger players on an international scale, right? Obviously, including not only the United States and Russia, but then also China, India, Brazil, and perhaps other BRIC nations, right? Of course, there is one problem, so to say, with this great power equality concept that was characteristic of the European concert of the 19th century, and that was the fact that the great powers sometimes treated rather cavalierly those nations that were smaller than them, right? So one has to perhaps reinvent this idea of a global concert of bigger powers in ways that would be accommodating the aspirations and interests of the smaller regional nations.
Mm-hmm. Now, also in one of your articles, you mentioned that the United States or the Americans always got surprised when other nations, non-Western in their mentality, get sort of westernized or get a developmental boost without becoming like them, or rather without becoming subservient to them. And that applies not only to Russia, but also to Turkey, to China, and perhaps many other countries. Do you think it's just the Russians who cannot find peace with the American version of the world as led only by them?
No, I think that Russia is certainly the first non-Western nation to undergo Westernization without losing its geopolitical sovereignty, as it were, right? But it's not the only one, right? Because one can probably place Ottoman Empire, then Turkey in the same category. One could place Japan until the Second World War into this category. With China, it's a little bit different because, of course, there was about a century of almost like quasi colonial situation in which China was, right, in the late 19th and early 20th century. But definitely, we are dealing here with a fundamentally similar entities, right, that are distinguished not only by their military importance, by their economic size, but then also by certain psychology, collective psychology of their elites that seek to integrate a certain measured amount of Westernization, Western influences with the geopolitical sovereignty. One could also place perhaps Iran in the same category. That is likewise a country that has a long history of Westernization, but then also of anti-Western attitudes.
You mentioned in your article very diplomatically that this historic lack of experience of weighing or negotiating your own interest against the interest of others may be somewhat problematic for the world today. Do you think the Americans could be disabused of this kind of entitlement? And if so, how?
Well, I think that we have some examples of that in the past, and I mentioned the détente of the late 1960s and early 1970s, when significant foreign political defeats brought about for a moment this prevalence of essentially European-style diplomatic culture embodied by Henry Kissinger, right, the presidential advisor to Richard Nixon and later State Secretary.
Who wrote his thesis, by the way, on the European concert as well.
Absolutely, on the European diplomacy at the time of the Vienna Congress, the high point of the European concert, right, the concert of great powers, right? So the European influences in détente and in the American aspects of the détente are unmistakable and undeniable. Right. So, of course, it is not excluded in principle, but of course, it will be a very long process that will require a lot of effort on the part of, once again, those countries that we mentioned, right, that combine a certain degree of Westernization with the attachment to an independent geopolitical role.
Victor, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me too. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.